Okay, great. Let me just fix my kind of video settings here for a second. All right, I'm not sure why I'm seeing someone else rather than me, but okay, I'm just gonna get started. Technical stuff is so bothersome, but anyway. So welcome everyone. Like I said, this is a state settlement in Pennsylvania. For those of you who are attorneys, you can get one CLE credit from this, and you'll get a code at some point during the presentation to write down. I wanted to, a couple of housekeeping things. So questions. I will take questions throughout, and there's two ways to ask questions. So again, on the Zoom template at the top of your screen, there is a chat feature. If you go to more on the right hand side where there's the ellipses there and you press on that, there's a chat feature. And so at any point you can just chat a question and we can take that. That's the first way to do it. The second way to do it is to just send me an email. So I will be checking my own email, paula@paulajoneslaw.com. throughout the my presentation, and I'll take questions that way as well. So either way is fine. Okay, welcome everyone. And I hope everyone can hear me okay. Again, let me just continue to record here. Okay, we got it. All right, great. Okay, so estate settlement in Pennsylvania. Talk on various subjects, and I wanted to do this one. I'm sorry, I really am trying to get my own video up there. There we go. There I am. Thank you. Okay. So I wanted to do estate settlement in Pennsylvania. There's a lot of stuff out there on estate planning and I just kind of thought, oh, let's kind of get to some really basic stuff here. And I think for all the non-attorneys online, which we have quite a few, I don't think there's a lot of information necessarily out there about the estate settlement portion of things. And so there's a lot of questions about it. Why does it take so long? Why can't people just get money right away? You know, if you ever hear complaints from beneficiaries, like we attorneys do as well, this is just gonna answer some of those questions. And what it is just going through kind of from beginning to end what may or may not be involved in estate settlement in Pennsylvania from beginning to end, just so I find it better working with any kind of clients that you have a better idea of what's involved and that it can be a long process. You know, it's a year or two, kind of, that's my average anyway. It's about a year or two. If you get something wrapped up in a year, your clients love you for that. But okay, so let's get started. So we're going to talk about today, and forgive me just fiddling a little bit with the technology here. All right, so what we're going to talk about today is testate versus intestate estates, which is when you have a will or if you don't have a will. So what happens if you don't have a will. The process of valuing the estate, how do we do that? The types of property and the titling of those property determines how assets pass. We're going to have an overview of that. That, I think, is one of the biggest misconceptions, is that people think, well, everything I own passes through my will. That is not true at all. And it's the most overlooked, I think, part of estate planning, is that when someone's estate plan is put together, it's really, really important that the titling of the assets happen when the estate plan is all signed, that the titling or retitling of assets has to occur after that point. So an estate plan is not, drafting stuff. That's one part of it, but a very important part at the end is taking a look at how all the assets are titled and making sure that they concur and are flowing with the estate plan that your client just spent quite a bit of money to put together. So we're going to talk about that. Costs, fees, and taxes, always the big thing. What's a probate fee? What are any other fees that may be involved? Court fees, you know, any of those kinds of things, advertising, all of that. And then taxes. Who is subject to what taxes? Revocable trusts, very popular topic. In most states, you're going to automatically get a revocable trust. That is not necessarily the case in Pennsylvania. We're a little bit unique in that way. The probate process, what does probate actually mean? What is the probate process? And is that also a full estate administration? Not necessarily. And then finally, we're going to kind of compare estate administration versus trust administration. So if someone has a will and dies with a will and they are administering the estate that way versus someone who had the revocable trust and the revocable trust has to be administered at that person's death. How is that different and what are those differences? Okay. All right, let's start with intestate versus testate. What happens if I die without a will? It's one of the most common questions that clients probably ask the other advisors on the call here before they ever get to their estate attorney. And what we appreciate, speaking for all estate attorneys, we appreciate that you inform your clients that they should have at least a will, a power of attorney, a medical power of attorney in place. And a popular question is, well, what happens if I don't? Okay, well, here's what happened. So every state is different. Every state has their laws of intestacy. They're similar, but they are, you know, the details of them can be different. And basically the way I explain it to clients is this. You have a will. The state has written a will for you if you haven't written one for yourself. Okay, and the state writes your will by the intestate law. Okay, so in other words, so if I do nothing and I have no will at my death, the state of Pennsylvania has had this law in place, the laws of intestacy, which goes through and says, well, then here's who gets your stuff. All right. Later, we will. I will explain what probate property means. So when we're talking about intestate versus testate, we are talking about probate property. In other words, the property that would ordinarily pass through your will, if you don't have the will, this is how that property will pass. There can be lots of other property that you have that would not necessarily pass through your will, and it's going to go, you know, according to this. And the property outside of the will is going to pass on its own, and we'll get to that. That's where we go into asset titling. We're going to talk about that. Okay. Okay. So if you're married with no children and no parents surviving, that is the only scenario in the state of Pennsylvania where your entire estate goes to your surviving spouse. Big surprise for a lot of people. Lots of people say, well, if I'm married, I'm good, right? My spouse gets everything. No, that is not true in Pennsylvania. If you are married with no children, but you have parents who are living, the first $30,000 and one half of the balance goes to the surviving spouse, the rest goes to parents. It's a really weird. I had a friend who learned this law the hard way. Didn't have any kids, parents still alive. Spouse died, unbeknownst to her, no will, about half of what would have normally been coming to her, in fact, went to her husband's parents. Not a good time to learn that. If you are married with children, whether you have parents living or not, the first $30,000 plus one half of the balance goes to the surviving spouse, the rest goes to children. Okay. So again, maybe not so bad, but if you're the surviving spouse and you need everything to live on and your children wind up getting it, then that's a problem. All right, what if you're single? So if you have children, it goes to children first. If you're single, if you don't have issues, then it goes to your parents, then siblings, then grandparents, then uncles and aunts, then nephews and nieces, and grandnephews and nieces. And then if you don't have any of those people, then that property escheats to the state of Pennsylvania, or the state of Pennsylvania winds up with your stuff. All right. So another misconception that I hear a lot of people say is, if you don't have a will, everything goes to the state. Well, fortunately, that is not true. However, if you get down the line and you're not having these relatives, then yes, eventually it will get to the state of wherever you reside. Other states' laws of intestacy go out much further than the state of Pennsylvania does. They're like third cousins, seven times removed. You know, they just keep right on going before it ever gets to the state. Every state is different. All right. If you are testate, right? So if you have a will, how does this improve any of this? If you're married and the spouse does not, if you are allowed to disinherit your spouse with a will, I can be married and have a will that says I leave nothing to my husband. Instead, I leave it to, you know, whoever the heck I want. The surviving spouse can claim 1/3 of the estate as an elective share. That's the only person who has a right to inherit from you. Okay. Otherwise, the estate passes to whoever you wish because you have a will. So you can leave it to whoever you want. Compare that to the laws of intestacy in the other column, which is you're always talking about spouse, children, biological relatives. I don't know about you, but I'm going to benefit friends long before I'm going to benefit, no offense, my aunt and uncle. Okay, but the laws of intestacy would not have that happen. Of course, they're making assumptions based on family relations. There's a whole lot of other people in our lives that we want to have our things that the law does not assume. So why does someone need a will? So that the people who you really want to get your stuff actually get your stuff. All right. What other benefits are there to having the will versus not? The administrator, so if you don't have a will, the administrator of the estate is picked by essentially family members and approved by the court. So in other words, the person who's in charge of settling your estate. Instead, if you have a will, you name your executor. Your executor can be anybody. Okay. It could be, you know, surviving spouse if you have one. It could be kids. It could be your best friend. It could be, you know, someone who you just think is really good with this kind of stuff. And that's actually really important to name that person. Laws of intestacy, guardian for minor children. Certainly have a will and pick your choices for guardian of minor kids. Really important. And it is often the thing that holds up people from finishing their will is that guardian of minor children. Otherwise, what happens? It's picked by family members, approved by the court. Different people can come forward and say, I think I should have the kids. No, I think I should have the kids. And it's a thing. You know, it could very well turn into a process. Other issues are minor beneficiaries. So minor beneficiaries may receive things outright. So minor, there's always uniform transfer to minors accounts that are kind of automatic for ages 18 or 21, sometimes age 25, depending on the circumstances. Like many of you attorneys out there who are estate attorneys, you're doing wills. People, when they leave things to kids, they define childhood as a whole lot longer past age 25 even, sometimes to 30, sometimes to 35 or beyond. So in general, the things that are in the law are not reflective of what the vast majority of clients want when they walk into my office and say, well, how old do you think you want your kids to be before they can handle money? And over 20 years, that age has gotten significantly later. But the law in states haven't budged much to reflect that change. Okay. If you have a will, you pick your own executor. If you have a will, you recite your wishes for guardian. You're going to name your first choice. You're going to name a backup choice. Under your will, you're going to ensure minor beneficiaries receive their inheritance at the ages that you want. You're going to set up trusts for them, probably. At the very least, I set up trusts for minors all the time. I don't ever put anything that just leaves everything outright unless the kids are, you know, very old and their parents are saying, yes, go ahead and give it outright to them. And even then, there's always a backup provision that says, if any of this property winds up in the hands of someone under the age of 30, you know, 35 sometimes, maybe 25, then the executor or the trustee can swoop in and keep things in a protective trust, not just in a custodial account. Okay, what other issues? Step families, very common. Stepchildren of a decedent are excluded. Why? Because they don't fit the legal definition of child. They are stepchildren. So they are not going to inherit anything automatically by the laws of intestacy. Sometimes that fits the situation perfectly because we wouldn't want to benefit our stepchildren anyway. However, what if we would? What if we raised those children and the fact that they're stepchildren is kind of a minor detail? Legally, it's a major detail. So if we really want to remember those children and leave something for them and provide for them, which a lot of people do, a lot of people have raised someone else's kids and their kids, right? You got to put that in a will. You've got to spell that out. And we do this all the time with the definition of children. We specify that the definition of children includes, you know, all these other people who would not normally automatically be included in a will. You can do that with a will. Laws of intestacy are not going to reflect that. Finally, in a second marriage at spouse's death, very common scenario. All right, you have a second marriage. You have, let's say, husband passes away. Husband has, you know, grown children from his first marriage. Husband leaves everything outright to surviving spouse. Surviving spouse, who is not the mother of husband's children, now receives everything outright. Surviving spouse also has children that that spouse did not share with husband. And without realizing it or sort of meaning to, that person is going to have a will that leaves everything to her children and not to husband's children, right? So the laws of intestacy are not going to pick up on that, but a will can make sure that husband says, okay, fine, I'll leave everything to you for your lifetime, but then at your death, anything left in the trust that I've created for you must go back to my children. So again, step families is a way to make sure, and you would need a will for this, it's a way to make sure that everything gets ultimately, long after you're gone, that the right beneficiaries are in the right order and, you know, you don't inadvertently wind up disinheriting your children. Really, really happens all the time. All the time. But a will fixes that. All right. So those are all the arguments as to why people need a will and all kinds of fancy things that they can do with them. Any questions on that? Okay. All right. So what do we do next? So when someone passes away, we are going to do we're going to gather assets, right? So an executor has been named, or if, you know, if the person didn't have a will, an administrator has been named. And so that person's job is to first kind of inventory all of the assets. They're going to gather together everything that the person owned. They're going to figure out how things are titled. Did they own them with someone else? Did they own them outright? Was there a beneficiary designation? And assets mean everything. Everything that the person had an interest in. Cash, securities, real estate, qualified retirement plans, life insurance, annuities, businesses that they owned, had an interest in, whatever, loans that they are owed at their death. You know, they loaned out something to someone, that person owes them money. That's an asset of the estate. Tangible personal property. That's the stuff in the house, the furniture, the jewelry, the clothing, the car. You're also going to gather together debts and the titling of that. So just like you have your list of assets and figure out the title, you've got to have the list of debts and figure out the title of that as well. Mortgages, home equity loans, student loans, credit cards, auto loans, business loans, and is there any, you know, is it separate just for the business, that loan, or is the decedent actually a guarantor for that? Is it the kind of business where everything is handled in the decedent's estate anyway? You've got to look into things like that. So again, the titling of that mortgage, is it a joint mortgage? Is it, solely the debt of the decedent? Is there anyone else involved? All right. So they're going to gather together that information because then they have to figure out what do we do with all this? Okay. So let's talk about asset titling. And we're also going to learn what probate property is, okay? So when you own an asset, when the decedent owns an asset, there's four types of property that they can own. The first one, this is in no particular order, is beneficiary designation property. that's the kind of property that has a form, a beneficiary designation form, that says, upon my death, here's who gets this. Popular forms of, let me jump ahead to this, popular forms of beneficiary designation property is life insurance and qualified retirement accounts, annuities. So there's a form attached. You fill it out at some point. We've all done this. If we get life insurance, if we get make our individual retirement account, our 401k plan, you know, every now and then, if we update our titling on things, we're going to fill out that form and take a look at it and go, God, I haven't looked at this in years and years, and just make sure that those are updated. So this is a good reminder for everyone to just, for yourselves, make sure that your beneficiary designation forms have been updated lately and that you know what they say. Not uncommon at all for someone to pass away and lo and behold, they had named a previous spouse on a life insurance policy. Not much you can do about that, which is shocking for a lot of people to learn. Qualified retirement accounts, for most of them, there's actually a law that says it's got to go to the spouse, and if you're not naming your spouse actually has to waive that, you know, has to approve that. So, you know, they have to be okay with that. And that's not uncommon. There's a lot of spouses who aren't going to benefit one another at death and they keep their money separate and all that good stuff. So you can still make sure that that happens, but there are at least some protections in qualified retirement plans so that someone doesn't by accident, like leave an entire 401k plan to a previous spouse. Life insurance, you're not as lucky on that stuff. There's some scenarios where you can fix it, but generally not. Okay, other beneficiary designation property is payable on death, like POD at the end of an account. In trust for, ITF, is something, so you know, you'll have a savings account and it will have the decedent's name and then POD and the name of a child or a grandchild or a niece or a nephew or something. And what that means is at the decedent's death, that account just automatically passes to the beneficiary that's named. Okay. All right. That's beneficiary designation property. Let's talk about joint property. There's all different kinds of joint property. The one that's most common or that people know most about is, you know, a married couple owns things jointly. Their home is joint. Their bank account is joint. Maybe their brokerage account is joint. You know, that kind of property. And what that will say, there's different types of joint property. So tenancy by the entireties refers to a married couple only. So if two friends get together and they are both on a bank account, that can't ever be tenancy by the entireties. That is specific for legally married couples. Okay. There is also joint tenants with right of survivorship. So I'm sorry, let me back up. Tenancy by the entireties also has right of survivorship. So wife passes away, husband is the automatic owner of an account that is titled tenancy by the entireties. Okay. Joint tenants with right of survivorship, you'll also see that spelled out. No mention of entireties because you're not dealing with married people, but two friends, a parent, child, you know, whoever else, same titling, same effect in that at the death of the first tenant, the surviving tenant automatically now owns 100% of the asset, whatever it may be. Okay. It can be show up many ways on a bank statement or a brokerage statement. It's Jane Doe or John Doe, Jane Doe and John Doe, JTWROS is joint tenants with right of survivorship. ATBE is as tenants by the entireties. There's a lot of other initials, but that's what that's referring to. Tenants in common, I'm just going to briefly mention it. It operates differently. It's not that common, a titling, a form of joint property. I think the most common scenario where it happens is you have two siblings, let's say, who decide to go into invest in some real estate together, and they buy an investment property, and it's, you know, sister one and sister two, and they're going to title that home, and let's say they put equal amount of money into it, they're going to title that home tenants in common. And what that means is that there is no right of survivorship. So sister one passes away, sister two does not automatically now own 100% of the home. Instead, sister one's 50% interest in that home passes through her will, through her estate, and goes to her beneficiaries. So a lot of times when you have the family vacation home or the family homestead where you have grown children and growing up grandchildren, and the desire of the parents is for it to stay in the family so that the family can all sort of come together at least once a year and reconnect. It's a dream. It doesn't always, that's difficult to to make happen, as I'm sure a lot of you are familiar. But tenants in common can be one way that it makes sure that it continues down the family line rather than across to the joint tenant. So that's what tenants in common is. Okay. Property and trust, we'll talk about that in a second when we're using revocable trusts. And then finally, that leaves us with solely owned property. So if you don't have a beneficiary designation, it's not owned jointly with anyone else. It is not held in a trust. It is in the decedent's sole name. Solely owned property is probate property, meaning that at the decedent's death, whatever they own in their sole name, no beneficiary designation, not joint with anyone else, not held in a trust, it passes through their will or through the laws of intestacy. That's what probate property is. So that's why I said some people die with probate property. Some people don't have any probate property at all. If I have everything jointly held, my home, my bank accounts, and my qualified retirement plans have a beneficiary designation named, I may not have any probate property at all. I might have a will, but nothing's going to pass through it. All right. So that's why it's really, really important at the end of an estate plan to make sure that that titling of assets really happens. Okay, that's our asset titling. Any questions on that? I'm just going to pause for a second, see if there's anything there. Sorry, I keep playing with the video because I don't know why. I'm seeing like five people on the one end of that, and I don't know why. Okay. Sorry, I won't keep harping on that. Okay, let's talk about in trust property just for a moment. Okay, so when we deal with revocable trusts, right? Some people have a will, some people have revocable trusts, and you should always have a will, but a revocable trust is something that a living person creates, and it is in existence as soon as they sign it. It's essentially, it's a pot to hold things in. You can decide whether or not to put assets in your revocable trust or not. So there's a lot of people with revocable trusts, nothing's actually in it yet. And along with that, they'll have a will that says, at my death, if there's anything that passes through my will, dump it into my revocable trust and do whatever my revocable trust says to do with it. Okay, what is the point of this? Why not just have a will? So a lot of people in many, many states, the probate process, which I will talk about, is expensive. The legal fees are through the roof. It's long and drawn out, and it makes people miserable. And that is true in many states, in about 40 states or so. Pennsylvania does not happen to be one of them. New Jersey also does not happen to be one of them. New York can also be really easy. So it just so happens we kind of live in an area of the country where it's kind of easy. But in a lot of other places, probate is sort of this prohibitive, burdensome, long, drawn out thing that can actually be pretty expensive as well. So in Delaware, last I checked, the probate fee was 1.75% of the probate estate. So if someone dies with $1 million in probate assets, they're out of the gate paying $17,500 in probate fees just for the court's supervision of the process of settling the assets that are passing through the will. That's a lot of money, right? So that's a lot of money, $17,000. So if you can just pay an attorney up front to do a revocable trust and get all your assets in there, would you do it? Of course you would. So a million years ago, when I practiced in Delaware, everyone who walked in the door got a revocable trust along with their will. Of course, why pay that probate fee if you can avoid it? And if you don't need the probate process, you know, if you don't need, if something's not going to be contentious or, you know, there's no kind of looming problems where you would need a court's supervision on something, why not just, you know, forego the 17 grand? So a lot of people did that. In Pennsylvania, I'll show you a probate fee. This is Chester County. If you have $1 million, you're looking at $675 of a fee. There's some other costs and everything tacked onto there, so it's going to be about $1,000. Okay, huge difference from $17,000. All right, so that's just to compare. Okay, how do you get something into a trust? So a lot of people do this. They do the revocable trust, and they're like, "That's great. Now what do I do with it?" Okay. Here's what you do. If I have a bank account, and right now I look at the checks on my bank account. Remember checks? People used to use these. Okay, so I still use them. So when you look in the upper left-hand corner of your check, or maybe your bank statement, you will see your own name and your address, and that's it, and nothing else. If you put it in trust, what you do is you say to the bank, "I need to retitle this bank account." They send you 14,000 pages of paper. You're going to fill all that out. And basically what you're saying is, "I have a revocable trust. I signed the, I am my own trustee of my revocable trust." You generally don't, you're not naming anyone other than yourself as your trustee initially. And then I signed it on this day, January 29th, 2020. You're going to put all that information on your paperwork. And that's how you identify that's the ownership of the trust. The bank changes the, keeps the social security number, keeps the account under the same social security number, but changes the titling of it. Now it is in the trust. So now in the upper left-hand corner on the statement, you're going to see your name, comma, trustee, revocable trust of Paula Jones, dated January 29th, 2020. And that's how you know that it's in a trust. Everything you put in a revocable trust, you can take right back out again because it's revocable as opposed to irrevocable, which means once it's done, you can't ever change it again. You can't get to it. You don't own it. It's a separate entity from you are. Revocable trusts are ones that are able to be revoked. I created it. I can change it. I can amend it. I can get rid of it altogether. I can do whatever I want. It's mine. I own everything outright that is in the trust for from a ownership perspective, meaning I still own 100% of everything. I still have 100% control over everything in that trust. Okay, so very different from irrevocable trusts. So that's revocable trust. And what does that do? If at the time of your death you have put all the assets in the revocable trust, then things are not passing through your will. Why? Because we just saw that probate property was not beneficiary designation, not joint, no property in trust. What does that leave? Solely owned property. That's probate property. It's either passing through the will or going by the laws of intestacy. But if property is in trust, in a revocable trust, it passes by the terms of the revocable trust. So when you're reading the revocable trust, it's going to read an awful lot like a will. There's one very important difference. Number one, it is its own entity. Like, it is an entity. It exists. And two, there are lifetime provisions. So in the first couple of pages, you're going to read through and it's going to say, during my lifetime, when I've set up my trust, here's how I want my assets, any of the assets that I put in here, here's how I want them handled. I have full access to them. I'm going to operate as my own trustee as long as I can. If I become disabled, my backup trustee should benefit me with whatever I need out of my trust. And so it's going to say all kinds of things like that. A will would never say anything like that because they don't take effect until death. Revocable trust, as soon as you sign it, it exists. It is created. So there are subtle but very important differences between a will and a revocable trust. Those are some of the ways that they operate. Okay. Let's see, probate fee. All right, let's talk about costs, fees, and taxes. What assets are subject to Pennsylvania inheritance tax? So at death, there is an inheritance tax in Pennsylvania. Not all states have inheritance tax. And we went through a little time period where an awful lot of them were getting rid of them. That was after a time period where an awful lot of them were sort of considering to implementing them. It's all about revenue. So Pennsylvania, we've kind of been fairly uniform lately in the last few years with our inheritance tax. What assets are subject to it? All assets except joint property held by husband and wife. Anything passing to a spouse in Pennsylvania is not subject to inheritance tax. It's subject to inheritance tax at a rate of 0%. So in other words, you're not going to pay anything. So some people don't even bother filling out an inheritance tax return at death if everything is going to a spouse or everything is joint with a spouse. Sometimes they just don't even bother filing the form. Then they'll get a little love note from the state saying, why haven't you filed anything? Is it because everything's joint? Is it everything going to a spouse? You know, so property between husband and wife, even on the return when you're filling that, you don't actually even have to list the joint property if it's spousal joint property. Two, life insurance. Life insurance is specifically exempt from Pennsylvania inheritance tax. It just is, because there it is in the law. Lastly, qualified retirement plans if the decedent was under the age of 59 and a half. As we know, at age 59 and a half is when you must or you can begin receiving your qualified plans. Now, thanks to the SECURE Act, I believe we go to age 72 instead of 70 and a half, where you must begin taking distributions. But you can begin taking distributions at age 59 and a half. If they are under that age, those plans are not going to be subject to inheritance tax. If someone passes away prior to that time, they didn't have access to them without big penalties. So they're not going to get taxed for PA inheritance tax purposes either. Okay. What about federal estate tax? So federal estate tax, in recent years, the exemption amount has gone way, way up. And the assets subject to federal estate tax, really easy to remember because it's everything. Everything that someone has an ownership interest in is subject to federal estate tax. Simple. Here's the exemption though. It's $11,580,000 in 2020. It's indexed, so you know it ratchets up a little bit each year. And this year, that's the number. So if there's an awful lot of people dying with less than $11.5 million, they are not subject to federal estate tax. A few short years ago, it was $5 million. A few short years before that, it was $2 million. So it has not been that long. In 2006, it was $1 million under the law. 2020, and it's $11.5 million. Big changes. Okay, so the vast majority of people are never going to have to pay that tax, but it's good to know. That's federal estate tax. The existing law on federal estate tax sunsets on December 31st, 2025. If the law is changed before then, so be it. And if it isn't, then in 2026, we apparently go back to what the law was before. And so again, we're looking at this like huge change in the exemption amount. And we've been through that so much in 2010, again, in 2012, there was a lot of, you know, what is Congress going to do? What are they going to do? So we have a little bit of breathing room until 2026 to figure out what's happening with it. And there's always planning opportunities when laws like that come along. And so it's something that we're keeping out there on the horizon for clients who are on the wealthier end of things. Tax rate of federal estate tax is 40%. It's always been big. It's always been a big number. It's a big number. But the 11.5 makes it not an issue for most people. Okay, those of you attorneys who want CLE for this, the code is Estate 2020. So after the presentation, you can email me if you would like credit and I'll submit that for you, but you got to give me the code. All right. Probate process. So someone passes away. They do have assets passing through a will or by the laws of intestacy. What does the probate process look like in Pennsylvania? It's not horrible. It's really not. It's just not that bad. So the client can show up at the orphan's court in the county in which they were, in which the decedent was resident. So if you're living in Philadelphia, you're Philadelphia County, you walk in, you don't need an appointment, you walk into the Register of Wills office and you say, hi, I've got an original death certificate, I've got maybe original will, or this person didn't have a will, what do I do next? And the lovely helpful clerks will sit you down and say, okay, we'll put together some paperwork, you can do stuff online now, which is kind of saves time, and you're going to fill out some basic information about the decedent, the social security number, you know, the address, the executor information or the administrator information, that person's contact information, et cetera, et cetera. And then they're going to take a look at the will, make sure that it really conforms with all the requirements of a will. They're going to figure out if we need to get in contact with any of the witnesses or if it's been notarized, you shouldn't need to do any of that. And then the executor is going to get little permission slips from the court that they call short certificates or letters testamentary or letters of administration. It's all referring to the same thing. That's the permission slip that gives the executor the legal authority to walk into a bank and say to the bank, the decedent had three accounts here and I need to do stuff with them. You know, I need to pull them all into an estate account, or I need to distribute them to beneficiaries, or whatever it is that they've decided that they need to do with that. And the bank is going to look at them and say, well, you're not the decedent, and so what legal authority do you have? That's what a short certificate is. Okay. So they've been, the executor has been to the Register of Wills, they have taken an oath that they're going to do exactly what the will tells them to do, that they're not going to take any of the money for themselves, they're not going to misuse any of the money, all of this. Very important to name an executor and fiduciaries that you trust. Because if someone holds up their hand, lies through their teeth, turns around and tries to take money, you know, what are the chances of them actually getting the money back? I mean, this is why the court is there, to sort of chase around after people. But like anything else, if someone steals something, my guess is it's gone 2 seconds after it's stolen. So name people you trust to begin with, your life will be a whole lot easier. There's a notice to beneficiaries that is required. It's just some paperwork. They have the forms, you fill them out, you send them out to beneficiaries, whether they're beneficiaries that are named in the will, but you will always also name the who would have been the intestate beneficiaries as well. So in other words, if I don't benefit my children at all in my will, and instead I give everything to my next door neighbor is going to get notice, but my children are also going to get notice. Okay. So again, it just makes everyone aware of what's going on, so that if children want to complain, if there's like a legal reason for them to complain, like mom wasn't in her right mind and the neighbor probably came over and made her sign something under duress, then at least the children are notified that they can do something about it. They have standing to do something about it. Then you file a certificate of notice, again, it's a form. You let the court know that I've sent out the notice to beneficiaries, so everyone is on notice. If anyone's got complaints, anything like that, speak up. Inventory is due 9 months after the date of death, and that is a list and an exact value of only those assets passing through the will, only probate assets. Okay. Let's do a brief, let me just check for questions also again, quickly here. Okay. Okay, we're good. So I have about 5 minutes left. So now let's talk about trust versus, I'm sorry. So that's probate. That's not bad at all. You know, it's a report. It's some reporting requirements. And that's it. You don't have to have, you know, for all the people out there, which is most people who don't have a whole lot at death, you do not have to hire an attorney for that. Folks at the local Register of Wills are very helpful. folks at the inheritance tax department are very helpful, and we'll get on the phone with someone and, you know, help them out. So this, you know, you don't have to have an attorney. If life is a little bit complicated, obviously hiring an attorney can be a great thing. And sort of, if someone has a certain number of assets or above, I think hiring an attorney is worth it, you know. But it's the executor's decision. I mean, the executor decides when, who, and if they're going to hire anyone to advise them on the settling of an estate. Okay, so trust versus estate settlement. So we talked about how some people are going to have just the will, some people are going to have a revocable trust involved, and some will have both. So what are the differences in the actual process of administration? So when we're settling an estate, we refer to the decedent as a testator, that's if they have a will, and the settling a trust, the settlor or the grantor of the trust is the same person, is the decedent. The will in an estate, the will terms determine the distribution, who gets what, how is it done, which assets are passing through the will. In a revocable trust, the trust terms determine the same thing. Like I said, the two they're going to read very similarly. The will and the revocable trust, for good portions, they're going to look very much the same. We talked about how settling an estate, you're dealing with only the probate assets. Settling a trust, you're dealing with all the assets that were already in trust, and then all of those assets that were poured over into the trust if they were going through the will. Settling an estate, the will is filed in court. The will becomes a public document. For people doing genealogy, they love that people put wills in courts because they like to go read them to find stuff up about their family. Other people are very concerned about privacy and they don't want to have to file anything in a public area at all. Revocable trusts do not have to be filed anywhere. And so privacy is one reason why some people use a revocable trust, is that they don't want people sorting through and being like, oh, who got what? The qualified retirement plan distribution timing is something that you have to do regardless, whether you've got a will or revocable trust. Why? Because they don't usually determine anything to do with the qualified retirement plans. There are the laws in place that say when distributions need to be taken, can a qualified retirement plan be rolled over into, say, a spouse's retirement plan? If it's going to someone other than a spouse, then that is a beneficiary IRA or a beneficiary plan, and then the beneficiaries of that plan have to make various choices as to how they want to take things out. The SECURE Act that was just passed changed how beneficiaries who are not spouses are able to take qualified retirement plans that they've inherited. It used to be that they could take it based on their own life expectancy. So if a young person inherits someone else's IRA, the IRS guesses that they're going to live to be about age 83 or so. And so they get to, you know, each year take out a certain amount so that it gets exhausted by age 83, you know, and that's how they do that calculation each year. That has been changed to 10 years is the longest amount. So there isn't this kind of stretch IRA, used to be called the stretch IRA, where you could do all kinds of neat planning with the beneficiaries, 10 years. And so a lot of estate attorneys are kind of saying, okay, now that it's 10 years, how do we need to adjust things for our estate planning clients? That's a talk for another time, but that is an issue that is definitely out there now. Okay, where else do we go with... here we go. Continuing on in the settling, we talked about how all the assets are going to be gathered and valued. You're going to gather beneficiary contact information, figure out where these beneficiaries are. Sometimes that can be a lot of fun. Just had one estate where we were searching for people that have been unknown for 30 or 35 years, and we found them thanks to the internet. You gotta love it. You can really find anyone on there and, you know, make the call and say, by the way, you just inherited something. They were happy to hear from us. If they're under the will or under the estate plan, there are other trusts that have been created. Like I mentioned, trusts for minors. Okay, these are, you know, people under the age of 35, we're going to set up a trust for their inheritance rather than getting something outright. If you've got a lot of federal estate tax planning in the estate plan, and so we need a marital trust for the surviving spouse, or we need a family trust for some tax planning, all of those things, the trust entities need to be created. So an EIN number is applied for, bank or brokerage accounts are open and to be funded, again, in the name of the trust rather than outright to the beneficiary. That all is going to happen whether someone had a will or a revocable trust. You got to do all that. You're not saving yourself any time there. I mentioned how the inventory of probate assets is filed with the Register of Wills. You don't have to do any such thing when you have a revocable trust. Saves a little bit of work there. Either scenario, Pennsylvania inheritance tax return, federal estate tax return is due 9 months after the date of death. Big misconception with a lot of clients is that, oh, if you avoid probate, you avoid tax. No. If you avoid probate, you avoid a probate fee, which as we saw in Pennsylvania is maybe $1,000 if you've got $1 million in probate. It's a much bigger number in a lot of other states. So yes, you're going to want to avoid the probate fee by using a revocable trust. In Pennsylvania, not so much. And even if you did that, you are not avoiding any Pennsylvania inheritance tax return. You're taxed on it, whether that asset was in a revocable trust or not. You are certainly not avoiding any federal estate tax. Again, whether something was in the decedent's revocable trust has zero bearing on the taxability of it at the time of their death. So all the time people call me up and they say, I want a revocable trust. That avoids the tax, doesn't it? Nope, sorry. All right, what happens also during an administration? Expenses need to be paid. What are the expenses? The taxes, the costs, the fees. All of that needs to be paid off before beneficiaries are paid. And then we tend to wait until we get a closing letter from the taxing authorities that they agree with the tax returns that we filed and that they're not coming after us and saying you owe us more. You also want to wait some amount of time because not uncommon at all for clients to say, oh, by the way, we found another asset or we found another bill or, you know, something like that. One thing I should say earlier that reminds me. So there is a creditor claim period as well. And so when someone passes away, if you advertise, if the executor advertises, they're basically putting on notice to any possible creditors out there, basically speak now or forever hold your peace. And they have a 1 year period in which to present their claim to the estate. Even if it's a perfectly valid claim, but they're 1 year and 1 day late, 1 year and 1 day after the date of advertising, you do not have to pay that claim. So the advertising is something I do recommend for people to say, hey, look, whatever is out there, if it shows up 3 years from now, 5 years from now, even if it's totally legitimate, nothing is getting paid 1 year after the date of this advertising. You know, only the debts that we know of in this year's time are the ones that need to be paid. So that's a good way to, you know, make sure that nothing kind of crops up much later in life. Real estate may need to be sold. Tangibles may need to be sold, appraised, you know, some of that. Distributions, beneficiaries, some of them want distributions in kind, meaning I want mom's house. I want the actual house. I don't want the value of it or the proceeds. I want the house. And even if the will does not specify that, the executor, if they are able, could kind of have put that together and say, well, okay, you could take your inheritance in the form of real estate. And then the other two, you know, you still make sure if like the three kids have to receive everything in equal shares, they still have to receive all value in equal shares. But some of them want particular items in kind, you know, rather than in cash. Sometimes you can make that happen, and sometimes the numbers just are not there. You know, sometimes not. If the house is worth, you know, 70% of the value of the estate and the kid can't, you know, pony up the shortfall of the money, well, then the house has got to be sold. So those kinds of issues come up a lot with, you know, how beneficiaries are actually taking what they're receiving. advanced distributions may be able to be made when your beneficiaries say, I didn't know that this process was going to take a year or two, and I kind of want the money right now. You know, you may be able to do an advanced distribution. Here's $50,000 for each of you, and then you'll get the rest later. You know, that does tend to make people kind of be quiet for a little while the rest of this process goes on. And it's nothing personal to them, but some of them take it personally. Assets then are either retitled if they're distributed in kind, or they're sold or liquidated and then converted to cash and distributed to the beneficiaries that way. You can file an account in the estate of Pennsylvania. An account is something that is every single penny, you know, it is listed, and there's a form of accounting in Pennsylvania. There's a set format in which all of this would be reported, and you can file it in court if beneficiaries are going to start fighting about it, or if the executor feels like they are going, that a beneficiary is going to claim that they did it incorrectly or something. They always have that backup that they can file that account in court and then deal with it there in an objective environment. Otherwise, if everyone's in agreement, they've kind of been informed along the way, hey, I saw the bank statements, I think we're good, then you can settle an estate on what we call receipt and release. You can do this with probate, you can do this with a revocable trust, you can do it with both, where everyone says, yep, you know, I took a look at everything, I have no complaints, I'm releasing the executor from any liability here going forward, so the executor can just be done and sleep like a baby at night. That's most estates. You know, most estates are, you're just going to settle it informally. You don't want to have to, you know, be filing things in court. Finally, an estate pays taxes just like an individual does. So this estate or this revocable trust has been in existence for a while, right? From the date of the decedent's death until the assets are actually distributed to the beneficiary. What happens in that time period? Income is still being earned, dividends are being paid, capital gain is happening, losses are happening. There's still activity, and that needs to be reported on an income tax return. That's called the estate fiduciary income tax return. It's Form 1041, or it's called the trust fiduciary income tax return, also Form 1041. All right, and that's where you're reporting the income. You know, all the activity, just like you would have if the decedent was still alive and they would have had to have reported all of their financial activity on their personal income taxes. So the estate or the trust steps into the shoes of the decedent and has to file its Form 1041 because the decedent's 1040 ended as of the date of their death. So fiduciary income returns, people kind of forget about them sometimes. And you kind of hate to tell a client, yeah, we went through this whole thing and guess what? There's yet another perhaps tax return that needs to be done. But so that's a pretty long process. That's a pretty long process. I hope everyone sort of has a better understanding of that. And that's that. And I think we are at time. Yes, we are. We're 2 minutes to one. So thanks everyone for attending. I will be here for any kind of questions. You can email me. You can call me, do whatever. For those of you who want CLE, please email me. Just let me know. Give me the code and I will get that filed for you with the state. Thank you again, everyone, for attending. Have a great day.